Trump's game of power and coercion on behalf of Israel has failed. He's lost the strategic initiative in the Persian Gulf. And that's where we are. Now, let me point out something that I don't think we hear enough. You know, military power, regardless of what kind it is, whether it's Russian, American, Chinese, Iranian, German, doesn't make any difference. It's not an abstraction. One size never fits all. The use of military power always has great potential, but always has limitations. You can't understand it outside that framework of purpose, method, and end state. President Trump never felt constrained in any way by that framework. And so he opted for heavy reliance on a form of military power that was the wrong answer in the wrong place at the wrong time. So we've been organized, trained, and equipped, and you know this from your own experience, to fight a short, decisive campaign. Iranian military planners assumed that whatever happened against us would be long, exhausting, and attritional in character. So Iran's defensive power was designed from its inception to exploit the technological impact of persistent surveillance, which we have not evidently appreciated, linked to thousands of standoff attack systems, missiles, and drones. And they've exploited their formidable geographic position. As we've discussed before, Iran is kind of a giant fortress surrounded by mountains, bordered in the south by impassable deserts. You put all of it together, and it doesn't make any difference what General Keane or anybody else says. We have the wrong instrument. We're not organized for this. We're not trained for it. We're not ready for it. We're ready to refight World War II someplace in some other form with new weapons, but we're not ready to take on a state the size of Western Europe with 93 million people inside this sort of geographical fortress. But nobody bothered to look at it. You know, and this is back to my point on psychological bluff. Bluff can get you a long way. We know that from history. And President Trump is a master of bluff. That's what he did in business. Now, he also went bankrupt several times, from which he then subsequently recovered, obviously. But the point is, he's been able to bluff a great deal and get away with it. But this is not business. This is not the art of the deal. This is something very different. This is a strategic confrontation between Israel, the United States, and Iran, and increasingly much of the world, which he is not paying attention to.
And, you know, Doug, I want to go down this path a little bit there because I think it is maybe much more profound than people are aware of. When you talk about the kind of war we're designed for, sharp, quick, powerful, end, and then get off the table. And I think that we're seeing the limits of that right now in ways that haven't yet been very apparent to people who aren't paying full attention beyond the words that are coming up. And let me explain. So in the Russia-Ukraine war, they're fighting an existential war, really from the viewpoint of both sides, one way and the other. And they have this idea that they're fighting this long existential fight and a nutrition warfare. So they have both sides now have the industrial capacity that they can just crank out the kinds of weapons, whether it's drones or something else or missiles and all that goes along with it, and can sustain this for literally years. Even Ukraine, for all of its deficiencies, is able to manufacture this stuff and can drag this out for a long time. On the other hand, we have almost no industrial capacity. We have it's like this whole gorilla balanced on a little stick, because that's as far as if we can't sustain any kind of a fight very long, then it doesn't matter how many tanks, planes, aircraft carriers and the like we have if we don't have ammunition for them. And it seems like we're literally designed that we would fail if we get into a sustained battle anywhere. Is that close to being right?
Of course. And that's something that Eisenhower concluded after World War II. We were only really in the war fighting for about 3 years. Everybody else was in it for at least five or more. And he understood that the American population would not tolerate the inconvenience of a very long, drawn-out war. They could not cope with attrition. We could not take the heavy casualties. Things, by the way, that the Israelis are now finding out about their own society. And I don't think people carried the right lessons into the future after Eisenhower left office. He was always worried about the limits of American power. How far can we go and no further? And that's what led to his conclusion that we had to get out of the Korean War. We did not want to be in a war under any circumstances with the Chinese. And he came up with a solution. It wasn't perfect, but it worked, and it's worked for decades. That's another subject right now. But the point is that the attrition model that you're describing is something we can't withstand. And the Iranians, by the way, have built their entire force on the assumption that they would fight an attrition war. Now, you mentioned Ukraine. I think we need to be careful. Ukraine doesn't have much industrial capacity at all. What they're good at is making these first-person drones, these FPV drones. But the larger drones that they have sent into Russian territory and so forth couldn't exist without British and German assistance, and I would argue even Polish assistance, but largely British and German, a little bit from the French in terms of missile components, but more important than these unmanned systems, components that the Ukrainians can't produce. And that's one of the reasons that the Russians are justifiably angry with us, because we've allowed this corpse called Ukraine to stay on life support for a long, long time. And it should never have been allowed. I think what we're going to see this year is that that's going to end. I'd be very surprised if we're talking about this next year. I think the Russians have realized it's time to end this thing. It's going to be ugly, but they've got to do it.
Yeah, we'll see if they end up falling through with that. But swinging back to this one here, in terms of taking a look at where we are here, we're perched on this, I guess, foundation that can't sustain the weight much longer. And we're about to get into what that looks like, why the pressures from external are pressing on Trump. But so far, it doesn't look like he gets it. Because this is from today. This is, says President of the United States on Iran. We don't have to rush anything. We have a blockade, which allows them no money. It's a very simple thing. We cannot let them have a nuclear weapon because they would use it. But then let's take a look at a couple of things. And I know some of this you've seen already. This is from Dr. Chris Martinson today saying, look, gasoline inventories in the U.S. are at their lowest level in 10 years and quickly heading lower because we're artificially suppressing U.S. oil prices and exporting it all over the world. Unless they allow prices to rise and curb demand, we could be hitting tank bottom very soon. What do you say about this gasoline issue?
Well, I've listened to several different analysts who are more familiar with this than I am. You know, Luke Grohman does a good job on this sort of thing. So does Grundlage. And I think if you listen to Ray Dalio, his forecast is equally accurate. I think we're going to probably reach the bottom of the oil tank at the end of July, beginning of August. That's pretty bad. So I think Martinson's argument is spot on. The problem is we're also seeing inflation rise. It was 3.8% in April. If you look at the dramatic increase in inflation, combine that with the costs of energy, I don't think Donald Trump and his administration are going to survive in office. You know, if you go back through history, I would say that the probability of governments turning over dramatically in the West, in Asia, is probably 80 to 90%. I think we'll see 50, 60, 70 governments go under. I think Wow. We're going to bid farewell to Mr. Merz in Germany. I know Starmer is going to be gone in London. I think Modi is in trouble in India. India has always had a power problem. They haven't been able to build an effective grid. This has done terrible damage to them, from which they're not going to recover. So the problem with fuel, food stocks, food, and fertilizer, these things are going to plague us now for a long time. I guess we'll come out of this and we will do something akin to what we did after the energy crisis in the 1970s. That's when we built the Strategic Oil Reserve. I think we're going to see more of that. It's something I talk to when I speak to large numbers of audiences here and overseas. I talk about resource sovereignty, that if you want to be a sovereign, independent nation, you have to have a stockpile of everything from gold to uranium to rare earths to oil to energy, all of it. And if you're not prepared for the worst case scenario so that you can survive for some period of time without external support, you're probably not going to make it in the 21st century. I think we're going to see more of this in the future, not less.
And, you know, one of the things that's troublesome to me, you mentioned a minute ago that Jack Keane, he understands the reality. He's just saying this because if it's a paycheck, I guess. I don't know how many others fall into that same category, whether Bolton and Mike Pompeo are aware of this, too. And they're just going down this path because they get paid. a couple of questions on that. First of all, do you think that, or is your supposition that they can say something like this, knowing that it's not going to work out? And then the question is, well, then how do they navigate that once it doesn't work out? Because if you advocate that the U.S. government pursue this course of action here that you know can't work, then that means we're going to crash. And with all these economic indicators on here, that's nearly certainly what's going to happen. Then why would they make such a claim like that when it would seemingly destroy their reputation afterwards?
Well, let's go back to the question of rewards, monetary rewards. John Bolton received the Defender of Israel Award a few years ago. The Defender of Israel reward goes to whomever has done the most to advance, support, extend Israeli and presumably Jewish power as far as possible. He was given the award. What did the award consist of? A check for $1 million. Ted Cruz, the senator, just received the Defender of Israel Award. That included a check for $1 million. If you're wondering why people take these strident positions that are really senseless and irrational, I think you've answered your own question. They're going where the money is. You know, it's like Willie Sutton, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. So I think that's part of the question. Now, as far as the rest of it is concerned, what do you do when you have failed? You don't admit it. You try to distract people. And this is where we are at the moment. If you go into Washington in the corridors of power, right now, politicians and appointees are making the argument that President Trump was misled by his Israeli friends. And they're saying, well, you know, if he had paid more attention to his advisors, American advisors, the narrative goes, then things might have turned out differently. That's not true. There's a huge mountain of evidence right now that just like President Lyndon Johnson, Trump and his inner circle, including Vice President Vance, were drivers of military action and escalation. Trump seems to have rejected advice from those in and out of uniform who opposed it. Of course, we don't know who that is because we're not even sure anybody who was stridently opposed to this dumb idea was ever allowed into the Oval Office. But I think we're beginning to see everything sort of crack and fall apart. You know, you've got Benjamin Netanyahu. He wants this war to go on until he thinks it's over. He announced this morning it's not over and we have to continue. Well, there's no alternative for him. If he says, well, we tried, it didn't work, we've had it, what happens to Netanyahu? He goes away quickly. Then the other thing is that there's a reluctance to admit that both Congress and the White House have been the obedient servants of Greater Israel. They embarked upon this thing on the basis of assurance from the Israelis that not only would this benefit us and specifically benefit the politicians in Washington in all sorts of important ways financially, but it would also ensure that Israel remained the dominant power exercising military hegemony across the entire region. Nobody's going to admit that because if they admit that, they're admitting that they've effectively been turned into puppets. Nobody wants to say that. So then you get to the final part. Here's President Trump pulling himself together along with Bessent to go to China. And I think he actually believes that he's going to essentially deliver a hard, tough message to the Chinese. The problem is that China is in a very good position to survive all of these calamities right now. They have a huge strategic oil reserve. They've actually got various forms and sources of energy that are going to help them through this. They've got coal, which they can actually liquefy and turn into oil and gas, but they've got plenty of coal-fired plants. They've got nuclear power. And, of course, they've got the alternatives to the standard carbon-based power. But the point is, China's not hurting. China's not in a financial crisis where the country is on the verge of falling apart. That's all nonsense. The Chinese economy is strong. Its population, its society is cohesive. So, you know, Washington's foolish war on behalf of Israel has simply disrupted energy flows all over the world and done serious damage to American strategic interests. he should be going over there for a serious and frank dialogue with the Chinese and be honest and say, I've got to get out of this. This is obviously a mistake. We need to work out a different way. He might get some response out of the Chinese. It would be positive, but I don't see that happening. I think he's going to go in there and try to force things on the Chinese. It's not going to work.
Yeah, and I'm going to get to that in just a second because that's really important, especially because he's about to go there today. But I want to stick on this current situation here. You talked about the political situation, not just with the Jack Keynes and the Boltons and the talking heads, but also members of Congress and senior members of the government. One of the other things that's also at play here, which is shielding the information from the American public, is even in the oil industry itself. Now, Chris Martins and several others have just shown data, just charts that show we're in real trouble. Inventories of nearly anything is going down, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, gasoline stocks, I mean, anything you want to talk about. And then you get into here, this is from JP Morgan. This is also from today. It says, a core assumption of our framework is that the accelerating pace of oil inventory depletion will ultimately force the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz one way or the other. Our base case envisions the Strait reopens in June, anchored on June 1st for simplicity. June 1st, that's barely 2 weeks from now, a little under three weeks, following a clear and credible announcement ratified and confirmed by both sides, such as a statement from the UN Security Council. I mean, there's no evidence whatsoever that something like that is coming in the near term, and yet they're basing their base case on what they expect the oil market to do, and hence you have oil, I think it's just barely above $100 at this moment, $101 at the moment, which by most of the experts I've seen is way under what it should be to reflect the actual fundamentals in energy around the globe, et cetera. Why do you think that we're getting these kinds of optimistic comments from the likes of JP Morgan?
Wall Street hasn't figured it out. Wall Street, with very few exceptions, is living in the same sort of delusional bubble that Trump lives in. They're looking at the stock market. Trump's looking at the stock market. Their obsession is to keep the market up, to boost prices, because that's where all of these people have made their money. I think in the past, we've had discussions about different kinds of capitalists. There are financial capitalists. These are people that benefit from the transaction fees that fill their bank accounts. That's generally what you have in New York City. You have very few production capitalists. These are people that build things. They build factories, factories that in turn build something, whether it's rockets or cars or microchips, whatever it is. We have very few production capitalists in the United States. Trump is not a production capitalist. This is not someone who's run assembly lines, who's been down on those assembly lines and seen what happens and what needs to happen. This is someone who's made his money entirely through the financialization of our economy. These people are not in touch with reality. I talked to one recently on the phone who's very much at the center of all of this. And he said, Doug, you don't understand. Everybody up here on Wall Street thinks that the U.S. Navy and the Marines are going to bash their way into the Persian Gulf, take it over, and essentially dictate terms to everyone. And I said, you've got to be kidding. He said, no, that's what they think. And to a large extent, I think that's what's gotten President Trump in trouble. He goes back to this perception of the Second World War, back to the perception of other places and other times when we have used our military power successfully. I don't think he understands not only just how profoundly the world has changed and how the economy has changed, I don't think he understands how profoundly military power has changed. As far as he's concerned, the revolutionary in military affairs is a precision-guided missile. But there's much more to it, as you and I both know. So that's why we've got the wrong force in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong mission. And surprise, surprise, they're not doing well. Well, they're not organized to cope with this new strategic revolution in military power. They're not ready for it. And as we talked about earlier, the short war versus the attrition model. So at this stage, I think the problem is just blatant ignorance and then unjustified faith that somehow or another, the military is going to win this war. But the fact that they're not winning this doesn't have much to do with them. It's not their fault. You know, you can build the greatest force in the world. You can send it into something for which it wasn't designed and it will fail. That happened to us in Vietnam. That happened to the German armed forces that were never designed to fight a long war over a 1,000-mile front in Russia. Never. So when you do that, you fail. But this is beyond Donald Trump. I don't see any evidence that he's in touch with that. And certainly the people up in Wall Street are not.